Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. I'll be joined here shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Things are going to be a little bit different this evening. We got some things. We're building it as we fly it. Got some things that are going on a personal level on my end. But we are going to try to bring you guys the show nonetheless. So I'll be stepping away here shortly. Chuck will be driving us down the road for the duration. But before I do, we're going to go ahead and get the trend lines report from DAT to you guys. And this week, we're showing that the national average price of diesel fuel has dropped ever so slightly by 0.3 percentage points. So we're showing that the national average price for diesel is at $3.72 per gallon. And capacity tightens rapidly ahead of next week's peak and tree shipments. So spot rates for all three equipment types surged last week, especially in the Portland, Oregon, and Charlotte freight markets, which produced just over half of the 25 to 30 million trees harvested nationwide. In the Pacific Northwest, reefer spot market rates for loads from Portland to Los Angeles averaged $4.27 per mile last week, representing an increase of $1 per mile in the last month and $1.80 per mile from the very same time of last year. Further south, Los Angeles to Las Vegas reefer spot rates broke the $7 a mile mark ahead of Thanksgiving, averaging $7.07 per mile. So without any further ado, let's jump in and see how the dry van market was performing over the previous week. Starting out up in the northeastern portion of the United States, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate checks in at $2.61 per mile. Coming out of the southeast and mid-Atlantic region, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.71. Into the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound rate of $3.10. Coming out of the south central region, we're showing an average outbound rate of $2.59. And coming out of the west coast, we're showing that the national average spot rate checks in at $3.26 for dry van. Changing gears, jumping over into the flatbed portion of the report, we're showing coming out of the northeastern corridor, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.90. Moving down south to the southeast and mid-Atlantic portion of the United States, the outbound spot market rate for flatbeds checking in at $3.17. The average outbound rate out of the Midwest checks in at $3.29. Coming out of the south central region, we're showing that average rate for flatbeds at $2.95. And coming out of the west coast, we're showing that national average for flatbeds checking in at $2.76. And rounding out the report with the temperature-controlled or reefer portion of the report, coming out of the northeast, we're showing an average spot market rate of $2.97. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average outbound rate of $2.84. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound rate of $3.79. Moving down to the south central region, we're showing an average outbound rate of $3.09. And wrapping up, coming out of the west coast, we're showing that national average checks in at $3.66. And with that being said, and without any further ado, let me grab my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Chuck, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing well, Rico. How are you?
Doing good. So, Chuck, I got us up to speed. I'm going to have to, unfortunately, I'm going to have to step away for a second. I'm going to go ahead and bring up our guests. So I'm going to bring Justin in first. Justin, are you there?
Good evening, everyone.
Hi, Justin.
All right, and the second guest, let me see if I can make sure we bring them in. Karen, are you there?
Good afternoon, everyone. Good evening, Terrence? Everyone.
Good evening.
Okay. Got it. So, good, you guys, hey. I look forward to coming back and checking out the recording later on. I hate I'm not going to be able to participate much with you guys, but hopefully everything goes well. And with that said, I want to say I'm going to step out and step to the side. God bless you. Good night, everybody, from me. But we'll talk at you guys same time next week. And Chuck, you guys have a great show.
Okay. Well, thanks, Rico, and all the best.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the Rates and Lanes podcast tonight. It's an honor to have both of you. So you're both seasoned veterans in the logistics game. Kiran Narayan Singh and Justin Abaskov are both branch directors out of Canada for Traffics. And I'm going to throw both of you as a question, and whoever wants to take it first. But my question to both of you is, if you could tell the U.S. and Canadian governments what they could be doing to improve the lag in supply chain, what would you tell them? Justin, you go first.
I would tell them to elect you as the Minister of Transportation, Chuck.
I second that.
I think that would go a long way, and we would solve a lot of the issues that were currently happening in the global supply chain. It's a great question, honestly.
I appreciate that. But I don't want the job, I got to tell you.
No, it's a great question. Honestly, Kieran and I touched base for a couple minutes before during the hectic day just to kind of, talk about this topic a little bit and how it affects on a day-to-day. I mean, I don't know. I mean, government is ultimately responsible for kind of ensuring the vital functions of, the ports are protected and functioning properly. I think that's a huge problem. I think we should probably talk about first is, what steps can we take or the government take in order to provide additional support and alleviate all the congestion and stress going on right now in mostly the western ports such as LA and Tacoma, Seattle, and stuff like that, to get the goods out in a more timely fashion and out onto the shelves for consumers to buy for the holiday rush.
But how can how can they do it? What do they need to do that they're not? I realize that there's certain constrictions out there that that they can't help, but other things. I don't know, Kiran, what do you think?
I mean, when you're looking at the overall supply chain coming into the U.S. and Canada, most of the congestion is really happening in the West Coast. And if you're to look at what's going on in BC right now, as an example, you had a landslide that and torrential downpour that took out the one major highway, cut off access from the rest of Canada to Vancouver, getting to that port. And, right now with the state of things, Vancouver is arguably one of the top five ports right now in regards to how busy it is in all of North America. So I think that a big part that, the government can have a real say in is infrastructure and 100%. being able to improve the infrastructure around these ports. And with, there was that infrastructure bill that passed in the U.S. That Biden passed there with the port grants and having these pop-up yards and inland waterways and stuff that, can alleviate the situation. They were trying to get that out, rolled out before the Christmas season to alleviate the added congestion that they were expecting to see during the Christmas season, inevitably, that we see every year. And I think that Canada should really be taking a page out of that book as well, because if you're looking at Vancouver as an example, and then you have Prince Rupert that's just, you know, north of that, there's not much infrastructure around those ports that can facilitate the amount of congestion that it's seeing right now. And a lot of that freight that is going into that port is, or those ports, I should say, both of them, are actually freight destined to the U.S., but it's being rerouted to Vancouver and Port Prince Rupert. So, you know, where can the government really funnel the funds to really look at the infrastructure surrounding ports to, you know, have we learned our lesson from you know, the pandemic, and how are we going to really, you know, fix this moving forward to make sure that we have that in place to be able to facilitate for this kind of rush? I think that's a question that I would really pose to the Canadian government to see how can we do this better.
You know, one of the, I totally agree with both of you gentlemen have said. One of the situations I think we run into in North America is everything as a rule is based on a 4-year horizon, which is how long any of these governments are in power. So there's no long-term commitment to fix things rather than just patch them. You know, we've got, you know, the Coquihalla now is shut down. It looks like it may be shut down for the rest of the year. That's a vital link for truck traffic. The rails are going to start moving again, but that's on a wing and a prayer. That's moving by a thread, apparently, because apparently we're supposed to be getting another huge rainstorm tomorrow in the West. So lack of infrastructure and lack of long-term vision. And, you know, trucks are great. I got in this business because of my deep fascination for them. But my understanding is it takes 400 trucks to replace one train. So that's not economically feasible. And I don't think we've had a lot of investment in rail in this country. You know, we have two rail lines, CN and CP.
I think we could look to, I think it's sort of like when the pandemic first started, and a lot of people were pointing fingers at the U.S. and Canadian governments in terms of, you know, why weren't we more prepared for this? I mean, we've been doing this for a long time, and we have a lot of experience in this. And yes, there was a 2018 situation where with the e-logs coming into place, and then there was the driver shortage, and there was very little capacity for a period of time. And then it kind of regulated itself a little bit in 2019. Right. And then here we are again in a relatively same situation with a lot of the underlining same problems that were around in 2018. I mean, there's a strong economy, which is not helping. There's a lot of issues going on with the port because of, you know, the pandemic, you know, labor shortages, truck driver shortages. Just it's like the perfect storm of why things aren't working. But 100%. The question is, what can we recommend to the government to do to help improve the overall global supply chain, or at least in North America? But it comes down to, I think, you really have to listen to, you know, dive into it a little bit and you know, figure out what's happening. So I don't know. Let's just use the Port of LA as an example. I think pre-pandemic or pre-this chaos, you know, a typical truck driver could probably go in and pick up, you know, turn around maybe 2 to 4 containers a day when there was nothing going on. Now the truck driver can go in and we'll wait in line, and hopefully he'll probably be in line for, you know, anywhere between 2 to 5 hours to make his 2 o'clock appointment. And then when he's actually in-gated, he'll have to probably, you know, hopefully get loaded within that 2 hour time period. And so now that causes a lot of problems. So if you really dive into it and realize what's causing the delays, it really, I think, comes down to maybe a labor shortage and then, you know, the overworking of every single port. And I think a lot of companies are trying to, you know, work around that by diverting the vessels to different ports, you know, either to people think that, you know, Seattle, Vancouver, or LA is a good idea. But what the government really has to do is focus on, you know, putting more labor into there, focusing on why it's taking so long to get a container loaded on a truck, and really dive into the problem that way.
Well, there's too much, you know, there's constrictions. It's like you've got a 4-ounce funnel, and you're trying to put 80 ounces in it, it spills over, and that's what we have at the ports.
Yeah, I think part of it too is the system that we have in the ports as well. The system wasn't built to take on this much, so we rely still a lot in the ports on human capital alone. And you know, even with the U.S., you know, the grants that they're the flexibility on the grants that they're trying to offer to the ports, you know, they want to try to improve the modernization, I guess, of it, to make sure that things are a little bit more automated, not taking away the jobs, but having the implementation of tech to complement that, right? So, because right now,
of course,
a lot of what you're seeing is people are physically working the cranes to try to make sure that we can get the containers off the vessel onto the chassis to get them out of there. You know, there's people physically checking quick cards to get them in gated and out gated as quickly as possible. And that's creating even more of a bottleneck. So now you have, like Justin was rightfully saying, lines of truck drivers waiting.
Oh, yeah.
And then, the delays are causing more delays. And it's almost like a vicious cycle because the systems that we have right now are not robust enough to be able to handle this kind of influx of freight that we're seeing. And I mean, it's not surprising because North America is the biggest importer in the world. We're the biggest consumers in the world. And, you know, we want to try to, we're always looking for the next best thing, innovations and all these different things. But I think a lot of the time we're not focusing on the supply chain. And the supply chain always kind of tends to take a back seat when you're talking about innovation. We're talking about green energy here and all these different innovations for consumers, but then at the end of the day, who's taking care of the people that are getting the products to the consumers? So
right.
A lot of the focus needs to be diverted away to where the root cause of this is coming from and how do we get, because it's always about how do we keep the consumer happy. That's the North American culture. How do we keep the consumer happy? How do we keep the consumer to come back to us all the time? The government has to make sure, especially in the U.S. where the private sector is huge and, you know, it's a capitalist market. If you want that kind of economy to boost, you need to make sure that you're putting the right measures in place, even if that's from an innovative standpoint, to make sure that we are making the process as easy as possible to get these in and out of the ports, so that it gets onto the shelves and into the houses of the consumers quicker.
Yeah, but the whole thing right now, it's just such a horrendous use of resources. You know, you talk about lineups at the ports. Apparently, it is so bad at some of these ports that guys can't get chassis. And then some days, they're telling people, we're only going to be shipping red containers today, which signifies what the steamship company. So you can only pick up a red container if you drop a red container off. But if you only have green containers in your yard and there's no green containers to ship, you're screwed. You know, this is the sort of stuff that is screwing up our ports. And that's why we've got vessels that are over 50 days from the time they arrive outside the port until they're finally empty. That's a bad use of resources for those steamship lines as well. And I think all of us have seen the horror stories from our customers of our customers either needing finished manufactured product or raw materials that are stuck at ports. And I think everybody's heard the horror stories about what our customers have had to pay in demurrage.
Oh yeah,
the demurrage per diem discussion is going to be an interesting one. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to the shipper's expense to clear the demurrage and per diem accessorial charges that the SSLs are insisting on and benefiting from greatly. I don't know what's going to come with that in the near short term, but.
Are the steamship lines really benefiting that much? Because, and I'm not on anybody's side here, this is just a question. They've got a huge investment in these ships, and these ships are supposed to be turning and burning. They're supposed to get into a port and within a couple of days be offloaded and, you know, and on to the next place. And it's no different than a truck, except it's a hell of a lot bigger and uses a hell of a lot more fuel and costs a lot more money. So is it really their fault for wanting to charge extra? Their equipment's not being utilized.
No, I'm not necessarily here pointing the finger at the Steamship Lines for charging, you know, those accessorial charges because they obviously need the containers to turn and burn and have their business running. But ultimately, what he's paying for is the shippers and ultimately the consumers, which is an underlying, you know, the supply chain issues are basically an underlying influence for.
Right.
For inflation, in which the government, you know, should be concerned about and should be involved with. So, I mean, it's not necessarily the fault of the SSLs, but it's certainly not necessarily the fault of the shippers or the consumers as well. So, I'm just the point I'm trying to make is that they have to be careful about, you know, some of the charges and the backups required because. You cannot return. You're just saying they're only letting you ship or pick up red containers today out of LA, for example, right?
Correct.
And yep. Then they said you could only pick it up if you could have a return container, but there's no delivery appointments available for the return container. So there's this vicious cycle, which is ultimately being controlled by the ports and not at their own fault because they're just so overwhelmed with the activity. And it's just, I'm just kind of curious to see how we can implement to make this a little bit more streamlined and an efficient operation, because ultimately I think everyone will benefit to have this run a lot more smooth.
Yeah, people want their gifts under the tree. The retailers have been through, a lot of them have been through hell on earth, especially the small ones. They've been through a really tough time with COVID. They have an opportunity now to get back some of their losses, and they can't because their shelves are empty. And I've seen that here in Ontario. I was in a Walmart a couple of weeks ago, and I could not believe the amount of empty shelf space. And that's Walmart. So how does your little mom and pa hardware store, or mom and pa clothing store, how do they get through this?
And I think that opens up a bigger question as well, which is, you know, it might open a little bit of a can of worms here, but it goes back down to, you know, local suppliers versus international suppliers, right? I mean, historically, 100%. We always imported, you know, raw materials from Asia as an example, because it was so cheap, and they were able to produce things a lot cheaper than locally. But now, I mean, the question arises with the cost of shipping going up and, you know, the containers coming in from China are north of $20,000 right now, in
yeah.
some cases, even $30,000. So when you look at, and that's per container. So if you look at the cost of shipping, you know, the question is it still feasible with the cost of shipping being so high? I mean, you're talking about, of 15, and again in the last example, a $25,000 increase. Is it feasible still to source those raw materials from Asia? And to your point, Chuck, you know, the SSLs, can we really blame them if they have to wait for their containers to be available to then take them back empty to China because there's nothing that we're sending back there? So,
right, not the amount that we're importing.
Exactly, right? I mean, there's a huge, huge trade deficit when you're talking about imports versus exports.
Oh, yeah.
And then that kind of raises more, you know, macroeconomic questions to the government, I guess, to say, you know, yeah, and I'm not an economist by any means, but would it be more feasible at this point in time? And I know that, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau was kind of alluding to this when he raised the concerns about the Canadian, I think it was the minerals that he was talking about that we use to make batteries and stuff. We are not necessarily, and he said, you know, the U.S. could do worse than getting these raw materials from Canada. But because Canada is a little bit more environmentally conscious, so extracting these raw materials is a little bit more expensive because of the measures we have to take to protect the environment. It's not necessarily cheaper to get it from us, but
right.
based on the supply chain bottlenecks, would you now reconsider that to say that maybe we might have to look to north to our neighbors to get those, right? So those are the types of questions I think that we really need to be asking, you know, the governments, both the U.S. and Canada, to really see where are we moving forward economically? Because, you know, from a financial standpoint, yeah, we could understand that before things were a lot cheaper from China. Canada's guilty of doing it as well. We were importing these things too. But is it still feasible given the cost of, you know, shipping? Would it be more feasible
yeah,
to
you're
look
right.
closer to home?
You know
right?
what I want to add? It's not just the shipping costs. China, and I'm just, you know, it's not just China. It's that whole region in Asia. Their labor costs historically have been much less than ours because their standard of living has been historically, you know, it's an up-and-coming economy. But now all of a sudden, because of artificial intelligence, you don't need that five-year-old laborer in a factory making wheels over somewhere in Asia. You could make wheels in somewhere in Ontario or Quebec or Michigan or Indiana with machinery. And I recently heard a story from an economist that had visited a Caterpillar engine plant 20 years ago and said, you know, he's looked around and there's all these guys, you know, just watching and really not working very hard, but it was labor intensive for the number of people that took to manufacture truck engines. And he said, fast forward 20 years, last year he went to a Paccar engine plant somewhere in, I think it was Indiana, and there was one man sitting at a computer, and the rest were all robotics and machinery, you know, different types of machinery that were totally being operated by robotics. So I think that's the new thing that we're really going to, if we're going to compare apples to apples, that's going to drive, you know, a resurgence in manufacturing back to this continent. And there's also that green thing. There was that that Glasgow summit a couple of weeks ago in Scotland, and you know these scientists said the shape of this world is not. We don't have long if we don't fix this. And I don't think having great big ocean container ships idling for 50 or 60 days in harbors, and it doesn't matter where they are, whether they're in British Columbia or in California or in Shanghai, doesn't matter. It's all the same earth. So maybe we do need to start manufacturing here again.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point because, you know, it is you, again, from the example that I was using with Canada, it is a little bit more expensive because of the environmental repercussions that we have to take into consideration and the measures that we have to pay for, essentially, to make sure that we're extracting these materials to be safe for the environment. And to your point, if you're looking at what's going on right now with these steamship lines that are idling in the ocean for weeks at times, is it safe? Like, what's the opportunity cost, right? So
yeah.
What is the opportunity cost in regards to the environment of having these massive steamship lines sitting idle, you know, in the ocean and versus paying a little bit more to extract these things? So I think these are the kinds of conversations that the governments need to be having. And then, you know, if we can limit the amount of steamship lines that are coming in because we're utilizing more of the resources that we have in our own backyard and with our neighbors, you know, that would definitely alleviate a lot of the problem. But hey, maybe the governments know something we don't, right? So, but this
no,
is, this
sure.
is,
you know
this,
what?
Yeah.
They're not supposed to because the government is supposed to be us. And if they're doing, you know, they're working for us, we elected them in our society. And, you know, that's supposed to be the whole premise behind a free capitalist society is we elect people that we want to represent us. And if they're making backroom deals against our against what we believe, then that's not good either. You know, we point fingers at the Russians all the time. Then we're no better than they are.
That's a very good point. A very good point.
You know, and I think that governments on both sides, I think we have to do something. We have a we do have a shortage of truck drivers, and I think that's also the that's really at the core of a lot of our problems. And that one's not going away very quickly because nobody wants to do that job anymore.
And yeah, I think it's actually getting worse.
It is. So you've got all the old guys my age that are getting out of it. They're aging out. They're retiring. Or else they can't pass their medical or they've had enough. You know, and that's quite common. So you've got that going on. And then you don't have anyone to replace them. And yeah, we bring in immigrants and we train them. And the big challenge there is if you're located in Canada, you can't send these new drivers to the border, south of the border into the U.S. because you can't get insurance for them because we have these nuclear settlements, which we talk about on this show all the time, for hundreds of millions of dollars because somebody lost their life. Pretty hard to put a price on someone's life. What makes one person's life worth more than another person's life? But, you know, they call it tort, what has to happen in the U.S., but nobody wants to touch it with 10-foot pole. And that's really hurting the trucking industry.
Yeah, that's definitely a big problem.
Was that Justin?
I was on a business trip in Alberta a couple of weeks ago for the week, and I was able to touch base with some partner carriers and customers in terms of, you know, how real the labor shortage and truck driver shortage is at the moment. I think, you know, in terms of maybe a government influence, either on the federal, provincial, or state level, I mean, I know that specifically Alberta, we're putting some initiatives in place to help fund anyone willing to go through the truck driving school. So at the time, I believe the cost was around $9,000 or $10,000, and would reimburse. Yeah. And upon completion of the course, they would get reimbursed a very healthy percentage of it from the provincial government. So, I mean, that could be one way, you know, either that could happen federally as a rollout to help attract, you know, maybe the younger generation to get behind the wheel. Or even more importantly, you know, we don't talk about this much, but, you know, immigration could be, you know, a useful way to address it. I mean, statistically, I think there's quite a few immigrants who are driving trucks. I mean, if there's a way to possibly get them more involved to attract more people to get into the industry and the business, I mean, that would at least help alleviate some of the shortages that we're seeing right now.
100%. Well, you know, historically, going back for as long as I can remember, the trucking industry always depended upon the farming industry for new drivers. It was always farmers, you know, farm boys or farmers in their off season that would drive truck because they were good with equipment. They weren't afraid to work. They were responsible because you have to be when you're a farmer. And unfortunately, in North America, we've run out of farm boys because farmers, you know, farms have become multinationals. And even if you have a 3,000 or 4,000 acre farm in Alberta or Saskatchewan or Manitoba, it's not big enough anymore. So, you know, you've got to have 50,000 acres just because of the economies of scale. So we can no longer depend on farm boys from North America. You know, we used to depend on them from the, you know, the Dakotas and Montana and places like that. So what we have done is we have taken the farm boys out of India and Pakistan, especially the Punjab region, because those guys are all farmers. They're good with equipment. The hardest part we're having, talking to so many carriers, getting insurance for them. Joanna, and that goes back to the nuclear settlements, because most truck crashes are $200,000 maximum, but then you get a real big one that's 10 or 20 million, and that really affects things. So, you know, that's another area that we have to look at if we're going to fix the supply chain thing.
Yeah,
Sorry, go ahead.
That's part of the. It's certainly part of the issue. One of the things that they're doing, I think it's in North Carolina. It's just coming out now, if I'm not mistaken. What they've done there for a container yard is they're moving the containers away from the shipyard where they're being offloaded immediately on trains. And they have a short transit or rail line that goes 10 miles or something into another yard. And that's where the trucks are picking them up. So you don't have the congestion at the ports. And that's what I think we have to start doing.
I 100% agree with that. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, if you look at Vancouver as an example, and Prince Rupert, we're always struggling to find warehouses that can take on more capacity for people, you know,
right.
Because the congestion that we're seeing in the port is because all these containers are just sitting there because there's nowhere for them to go while, you know, we're getting the trucks to come into these areas.
I
think the U.S., and I know one of the initiatives in this infrastructure bill, when President Biden went to, I believe it was the Baltimore port, when he was trying to roll this out, he was talking about pop-up yards. Because one of the biggest problems, and I know I was on LinkedIn the other day, and a truck driver took a video as he was driving out of, I believe it was the port of Los Angeles.
Right.
And there was a wall, essentially, of containers on the side of the street. And he was just driving out, you know, it was crazy. So you're seeing this wall of containers on the side of the street, and then you're seeing, that's the backdrop, and then you're seeing a line of drivers just lined up waiting to get into the port. And the same way we're diverting traffic away from one port to another, we're not really thinking about how are we diverting the traffic once it's inland. And the government, you know, I mean, there's so much crown land, for example, in Canada, especially in British Columbia, where we can have temporary pop-ups for these containers. So you're diverting the traffic away from the port to be able to pick up these containers. So even if, let's just say, as an example, the red containers are being picked up today, that's a really good idea to be able to put it on either shunt drivers, or if you're putting it on the rail. Again, infrastructure
be rail
in Canada.
Trucks are, you know what, I love trucks, but let's face it, guys, they're inefficient compared to even a short spur rail line.
Oh yeah, just the amount of capacity you can throw onto one rail card, and you just go there to the pop up yard. That'll probably fill up the entire pop up yard as is. So yeah, that's definitely something that I think will really.
But the problem with Vancouver, the problem with Vancouver is that real estate anywhere in that lower mainland is unaffordable to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other side of it. You know, Vancouver is a. Those are two bad examples, only because number one, Vancouver, the price of real estate is like insane. I have a daughter that just started selling real estate, and she was telling us that the house that goes up on the market for $2 million gets sold the next day for $2.4 million. It's ludicrous.
Well, she's in the right industry then, that sounds like.
Well, no, there's no, you know what? The problem is that there's no inventory of property for sale.
Yeah.
So that's not, you know, I don't know if Vancouver and Prince Rupert, that was a great idea. Now, my understanding of Prince Rupert, that port was built for Walmart originally. And so they could get their stuff first, have a rail line, I think it was CN, up there, grab those containers, and they would be in Chicago by the time, as compared to if that boat went to Vancouver, that freight would be in Chicago already rather than arriving at the port of Vancouver. But you've got one rail line and not a lot of infrastructure in the town itself. It's so far north. But the idea is great. And I think that was a, you know, leave it to Walmart. They're brilliant at some of their strategies. And that was one of their better ones. You know, maybe these are the guys that we need sitting at the table with our government officials advising on supply chains.
But yeah, that was a point I was going to bring up too. I mean, this is the beauty of the private sector, right? Because you don't have you're not held back by the regulations from the government that, you know, you can formulate these ideas and you can put plan into practice a lot easier. You're not held back by the regulations that you can, you know, they come up with these ideas because, I mean, these guys are, their whole approach, and especially Walmart being, you know, that's a great example. It's cut out the middleman, right? Get it directly from the supplier to the consumer.
You got it.
And that model forced them almost, not almost, it did force them to be as efficient as possible to keep their costs down. And again, one of the ways in doing that is making sure that, guys, if we have to be efficient enough to make sure that the consumer can afford our product, we're not, you know, they're quantity over quality, really, and they're trying to be affordable. So everyone, if you're saying, well, when you're talking about retail, one of the things that they ask is, okay, well, what's your target market? Walmart is probably one of the few companies out there that can say everyone. My target market is everyone, which means that I have such a huge base that I can't fail. I have to get these things to the shelves. So they find these innovative ways to get these things here. So having that private sector and having both sides of the economy, the public and the private, working together, government officials as well as business owners, that's where, I mean, if you look at history, that's where some of the best ideas came about. Where you had the meeting of these heads, you have the regulators and you also have the capitalists sitting at a table and saying, guys, how can we make this work? Because ultimately,
we need to have the transportation summit of 2022 and you're going to host it.
We're having it right now, man.
I agree. You know what? It's very true what you say. And part of the reason is, if you think of a company, and again, I don't mean to pick on Walmart, but I have a lot of, I do have a lot of respect for the company. And if you look at Walmart, the people that are making decisions there, if they make the wrong one, what happens to them? Their career is over. They get fired. Yeah. They're accountable to shareholders. And shareholders are tough. There's no, I'm sorry. You know, do better next time, George. You get the hell out of here. You just cost us a lot of money. Unfortunately, with government, you have bureaucrats that have lifetime, they've got lifetime tenures, and you've got politicians. And when the politicians fail, they usually end up as bureaucrats. And if they're really big politicians, they end up on boards. So it has to do with accountability. I've got a great logistics story for you gentlemen to share about Walmart, just to show you how innovative they are. Back in 2017-18, if you remember, when things went crazy with the ELDs and Walmart was threatened with not being able to stock their shelves because companies that had contracts with them couldn't honor their contracts because they couldn't get any drivers and things just went crazy. And Walmart was held hostage in many cases and had to pay a lot more than what they wanted to pay to get the product moved. Now, I don't think they paid $7 a mile out of California like I heard Rico say tonight. That's a world record. But they were paying a lot of money. And what the bright guys and girls over in Bentonville, Arkansas did to counteract that, they took a look and they said, well, hold on a second. We don't have carriers that are willing to do this. Why don't we take the carrier's drivers away from them? We know how to operate trucks. We've been operating trucks since day one. We've always had trucks. Why don't we get more trucks? And why don't we offer Swift and J.B. Hunt and Schneider and all the rest of CRST and all these other carriers that we're using, why don't we offer their drivers 25% more than what they're making there? Let's take those drivers. We'll put them in our trucks. Let's go to our suppliers and our suppliers that are shipping to us on a prepaid basis and tell them to stop shipping to us prepaid. We want the freight allowance, and then we can round trip everybody, and we can get our product to market. And that's what they did. And in just the last few years, that Walmart fleet has grown exponentially. That's how smart these guys are. And that's the sort of brain power we need to change the outcome of a supply chain so we're not held hostage. I don't think any of us like what's going on now. You know, it's tough. You've got to have some really difficult conversations with customers that are difficult because you can't always get them what they need. And that's not how we want things to go. So I think that's probably the best solution.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to operating costs, right?
One at a time. What's that, Justin?
I was just going to share a little interesting statistic I've read recently, and it was saying that any asset-based logistic company that had a fleet of over 30 trucks, 95% of their drivers would leave the company before a 12-month period.
I would agree. And what they're 100%, because people were just being offered so much.
So I mean, to help with the labor shortages and the driver shortages, I think maybe, and especially for the listeners on the show, I think maybe we could talk a little bit maybe about driver compensation plans, driver retention. You had mentioned the cost of the insurance right now, Chuck. I mean, ultimately, you know, I think it's important that we at least review some of these issues that we're having, because it's causing even more further delays on some topics. One perfect example of this is we were running about 10 to 15 or 17 truckloads a week from Mississippi to New Jersey. The business was drop trailers on both ends. And the reason why we were having a lot of complications wasn't because of on the carrier side, in which, you know, we negotiated a rate that they were comfortable with based off of, you know, the lane requirements. But it was because there wasn't enough money or there wasn't enough people to help offload the trailers
right
at the consigning. And this is the first time in my career where we gave a customer, you know, a breakdown and, you know, had really elaborate and in-depth conversations about, you know, the issues that we're having and how we could help our carrier and ourselves succeed and on this particular lane. And they ultimately had to give up because they were unable to find labor to help offload the trailers in a timely manner.
We're getting that all over. We're seeing that for loading and unloading places that should, you know, frozen food warehouses where historically you go in and an hour later, max 90 minutes, you're out of there 4 or 5 hours. And when you get to the other end, 7 or 8 hours. And of course, we're just walking away from that business because we can't afford it, neither can the customer. So, you know, that's a whole new thing. Now, I noticed that the really good places where we go don't have that issue. They have staff. They pay their people enough. you know, you can, I have this theory, and with our fleet, we have 10% turnover. That's it. And the 10% turnover that we have in our fleet is always the same people. And I equate that to treating people properly and hiring right to begin with. And I think some of this turnover in the industry, I think fleet owners sometimes are so desperate to put a warm body behind the wheel of a truck that they don't do the diligence. And it has nothing to do with the person's ability to drive a truck or their safety rating. What it has to do with is how often do they change jobs? When somebody comes in, and they, we look at their driving record and they've had 7 jobs in 2 years, we don't want them. Because if you talk to them, they've always got a story. Well, this guy, you know, everybody always mistreated them unfairly, all 7. Well, do you think 7 companies are all bad? You know, there's a thread there. So I think that's part of the problem. But I think if you treat people right, you don't have some of those problems.
Yeah, it boils down to the opportunity cost, right? It boils down to the opportunity cost of where do I want to spend my time? Do I want to spend my time doing the due diligence to make sure that the people that work, because ultimately, I mean, truck drivers have a really tough job because they have to not just haul the freight and deal with all the issues that they're facing on the road, but at the end of the day, when they get to the customer, they are the representation of the company. You know, so I think, and Chuck, I know you have done a really good job at this. I've seen this firsthand, where the opportunity cost is, do I spend the time doing the due diligence in the front end to make sure that, like you said, it's not just that I'm hiring out of a place of desperation where I just want a warm body in the seat of a truck. I want the right person in the right seat.
100%.
Right? And that's where we spend our time, because what is the opportunity cost of not doing that? If you're just trying to fill a body, well, now you have turnover.
It doesn't work.
Turnover costs. Yeah, it doesn't work. It costs money, right? If you bring the wrong person in, you have an accident. We're just talking about the insurance.
Oh my God. Yep.
You know, there's a financial, there's a dollar sign to that opportunity cost. So I think that's a big part of it. You know, making sure that you're hiring the right people, you're incentivizing them, you know, you're attracting the talent. And then once they come there, making sure that you have the right people that you bring into the company, and traffics as a family. So you're not just bringing them into the company, you're bringing them to the family, and making sure that they're being treated right. I think that's a very, very crucial part of it, is doing the due diligence in the beginning to make sure that it's not just the warm body, it's the right person to put in that seat.
There's a lot of time and energy.
Yep.
There's a lot of time and energy that goes into recruitment and setting expectations. But in the end, you know, it goes both ways. There has to be a lot of mutual respect from both ends. I mean, obviously, we want to make sure that we select good business and find good business that, you know, can pay the driver well and also make sure it's an efficient use of his time. But at the same time, we have to understand that it's a representation of us as well going into there and the companies that we represent as well. So I think Kieran, this is well said. I think Chuck, you've done a really phenomenal job with it with the traffic fleet.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, even as a broker, you know, working with our partner carriers, it's you know, I think it's that mutual respect about, you know, over communicating and setting expectations and understanding the scope of work on every single shipment and lane that we assign to our partner carriers, either being the owner operators or the medium to small size fleets that we work with. But you know, I guess we get to take this opportunity to also just say thanks to the drivers out there. I mean, they keep this economy running, and I know it's a stressful job and it's emotionally difficult being on the road and away from families sometimes, but I think what we have to do is just say thank you and also understand that we're trying to avoid just turnovers as well on our end, because we want to have some good representation for us.
Yeah. You know, and it's I think by working with your carriers, you get that continuous freight, which makes people's lives bearable. Makes the work enjoyable sometimes even, rather than sending them, you know, to 50, you know, a different state every week. That grows tiresome very quickly, especially if you're somebody with a family.
Yeah, and ultimately in this economy and in this current situation of what we're facing, customers really want service. And where does good service come from? It comes from the right drivers. So being right. able to build that partnership and making sure that we're sitting in the office, right? We're pushing paper. The drivers are the ones that are putting in the work. And, you know, yeah. I want to echo what Justin just said, because I think not a lot of people take the time to say these things to drivers, but they are the unsung heroes. They're the ones that are putting 100%. In the work. Right. And, you know, to any of the shippers and the consignees and, you know, other brokers out there that are listening, I mean, we need to make sure that we're treating our drivers the way they deserve to be treated, because ultimately, you know, it's very hard. It's very easy for us to say, oh, well, you didn't show up on time and what's going on. And, you know, oh, the customers are not happy. But at the end of the day, I mean, we have no idea what they're facing on the roads, especially with all the stuff that's going on in BC with the weather, you know, flooding, all these things.
Congestion in general is so bad. You know, that's
so
the other
bad.
Thing that these, yeah. You know, congestion in places where there was no congestion, 10 years ago, we've got it now because people have moved to outlying areas. And, you know, and these unsung heroes are dealing with this day in, day out, trying to make delivery appointments. You know, it's kind of great in some ways that we have these delivery appointments, but sometimes they just can't be met because of weather, especially when we have a tight window. If any shippers or receivers are listening that make rules, it's much better to have a shipping and receiving window and give those drivers a little bit of a break. That will alleviate a lot of stress from everybody, rather than a tight delivery time of, you know, you've got to be at door 28B at 4:07 a.m., you know, and you don't have the freight ready until 6 p.m., and, you know, the driver's got 500 miles. You're asking a hell of a lot from somebody.
Yeah, I mean, in this day and age, you know, you're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, right? I mean, the way that the system is operating right now, we need the delivery windows. We appointments 100%. Right now with everything that's going on, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. You know, and I say this to some people on my team, you know, imagine having to sit in an office, which is a huge open building that you have access to a bathroom to, you know, you can go to the little kitchen or whatever. You're sitting there for 8 hours. Now picture a driver sitting in a line going into the port for 8 hours in a truck.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference there. So, you know, we really need to start figuring out how to make these guys' lives easier. And it has to start from us, ultimately, driving home the message to the shippers and the consignees, like you rightfully said, Chuck, to change the way that we're doing the shipping and receiving hours, to change the way that, you know, you have to set a strict appointment, or, you know, if you miss this, you're going to have to wait God knows when. You might have to lay over until tomorrow, which is the other available appointment. I mean, it sounds easy, but you're asking, you know, these guys to stay away from their families overnight. It's not feasible. And you know, for all the truck drivers that are listening out there, you know, we definitely appreciate all the hard work that you're putting in, and we respect you. And thank you so much for all that you guys do.
Guys, I just noticed we're at an hour now, and hopefully I can catch this on tape so people can listen online. Justin and Kieran, can you tell the audience how to get hold of you if any of the carriers out there want to reach out to you?
Yeah,
Justin, you want to go first?
you can reach me at 905